Welcome to Painting the Midnight Oil Podcast with your host, Dan Oils.
So I want you to think back for a second to the last time that you were in a lobby or a waiting room. And if you remember whether music was playing or not. And if you remember whether music was playing, do you remember the type of music that was playing? And if you remember the type of music that was playing, do you remember the impact that it had on you? Now, the next time you go to a waiting room or a lobby and there is music playing, I want you to think about that. I want you to actively listen to the music. I want you to actively think about the impact of the music on your emotions and your state of being. And the reason why I'm asking you that is because I had a very intimate relationship with the music that I was listening to recently when I was waiting in the lobby of the cancer center, awaiting my results. And I have to say, it was probably the first time in my entire life that I'd really listened intently to the music and really started to think about the music that was playing. There's one study that I still haven't been able to find. I've spent a few minutes here prior to this episode trying to find the study. I can't find it to save my life. And it's very unfortunate because I remember when I first came across the study, it blew my mind. It was one of the most compelling and intriguing studies that I'd ever come across in my life. And the fact that I can't find it makes me wonder if it actually exists. Because it shouldn't be that difficult to find. There was a study, allegedly, if my memory serves me correctly, there was a study done years ago that showcased the power of our subconscious mind. And I referenced this book by Joseph Murphy, The Power of Your Subconscious Mind. It's one of my favorite books that I've ever read. It's a very powerful book. And it details the power of the subconscious mind. It details different strategies to tap into your subconscious and activate your subconscious to benefit you. And there's too much to list right now over the podcast. But if you are interested in personal development or interested in the brilliance of our subconscious mind that is inside each and every one of us, I would highly recommend that you pick it up and give it a read. But there was a study that I remembered coming across. I don't remember if it was included in that book, but I came across it in some capacity at some point in my life. And basically it was saying that there was a study done on participants that were listening to music that was either sped up very fast so you couldn't consciously pick out what was being said, or it was played at a very low decibel so, again, you couldn't consciously pick up what was being said. But the lyrics or the language was either very like vulgar or offensive or something like that. And they were studying the physiological effects of the participants. And so when the participants were listening to this like very stressful music, even though they didn't consciously understand it to be stressful, their body was reacting like they could consciously decipher and pick out what was being said to them. So it just shows just how intelligent and aware our subconscious mind is. Hopefully you have better luck finding that study than I did. And again, I didn't dedicate too much time over it, but nonetheless, there are some other studies that I did find that I found intriguing that go along with this, because I was thinking a lot about this, you know, recently. You know, this is from a more popular website. It's not really from a scholarly article, but it references a study that was done, which is the reason why I'm sharing it. So this is an article on CNN, but it says, researchers at the University of Groningen showed in an experiment that listening to sad or happy music can not only put people in a different mood, but also change what people notice. In a 2011 study, 43 students listened to happy or sad music in the background as they were tasked with identifying happy and sad faces. When happy music was played, participants spotted more happy faces, and the opposite was true for sad music, which I thought was really intriguing. Now, there are two more websites that I want to share with you, or articles that I want to share with you. All right, now the second article that I want to share with you is from Pfizer, and the reason why I purposely chose this is because Pfizer really it's not really in their best interest to share this, because Pfizer is a pharmaceutical company. So you would think that their bias is going to lean towards favoring pharmaceuticals or medicine to counter moods or to create certain moods, but they are admitting, I don't have any other evidence. I don't have like the author or date of publication or anything. The URL is too long to list, but it says why and how music moves us. So I'm going to scroll down a little bit. Under music and mood, listening to or making music increases blood flow to brain regions that generate and control emotions. The limbic system, which is involved in processing emotions and controlling memory, lights up when our ears perceive music. All right, and it continues, the chills you feel when you hear a particularly moving piece of music may be the result of dopamine, a neurotransmitter that triggers sensations of pleasure and well-being. As your brain becomes familiar with a particular song, your body may release dopamine upon hearing just the first few notes of the song. Just as Pavlov's dogs learned to associate food with a ringing bell and eventually began drooling at the sound of the bell, even when no food was in sight, our bodies actively anticipate pleasure upon hearing familiar notes. Interestingly, music can affect our mood even if we can't recognize or replicate the notes in rhythm. Science has documented numerous instances of people who suffer brain injuries and lost their ability to distinguish melodies but retained the ability to recognize the emotion conveyed by music. Researchers noted that these patients had sustained damage to the temporal lobes of the brain, a region involved in comprehending melody. Their frontal lobes, which play a role in emotional regulation, were unaffected. All right, so that is connected a little bit with my initial study that I referenced. And then there is one more article that I wanted to briefly share. I mean, there's a lot of information and literature on this topic online. A lot to do with music therapy, which I think is really interesting as well. But there's one more thing that I wanted to share with you. I think this is more well known, and this is from Idaho State University. The wonderful and rather dubious connection between plants and music. And this goes to, or this discusses how plants are affected by music. And one of the earliest studies was performed by Dr. T.C. Singh, head of botany at Annamalai University in India in 1962. Taking balsam plants, he exposed them to classical music and found they achieved a growth rate of 20% more than the control group, which had no music played. This held true for raga music as well, with it performing even better, lending to a 25 to 60% increase. Now, I'm not going to read the entire article, but there's one more that I wanted to read. So this is a little bit further down. It says, while the plants responded well to the single note classical and jazz music, they quickly began to wither when exposed to rock. The plants would also grow toward the music they liked and away from the type they didn't. So it's just really interesting. And I'm sharing this because, you know, music is an art form, as we all know. And I like learning about kind of like these alternative therapies, just like I've found oil painting to be more or less an alternative therapy that has improved my mental state and well-being. But it's really interesting to learn about how music can impact our mood, can impact our state of mind. And I thought a lot about this, you know, in my experience waiting in the waiting room or the lobby of the cancer center, waiting for my oncologist appointment to learn about my results of my PET scan. Now, just a brief summary. Right before the end of school, I was diagnosed with, at the time, stage 1 invasive melanoma. and they took a biopsy. And based on that biopsy, they determined that I had surgery on July 7th. They removed the melanoma with clear margins. It was a lot larger than they were expecting. It turned out to be a 2A instead of a 1A. That's just due to the size of the melanoma. That's what those numbers and stages represent. Because of the size, because it was no longer a stage 1 but became a stage 2A, if they knew that ahead of time, they would have done what is known as a lymph node mapping, which is basically a way to determine if the melanoma had spread to my lymph nodes, which would have been very problematic because lymph nodes are all over your body. Now, because they couldn't perform a lymph node mapping, they had to do a PET scan. And a PET scan is imaging, essentially, where they inject you with like a tracer. And basically, based on hot spots, because the cancer will collect these high concentrations of sugar, and these concentrations will appear bright or as hot spots on the imaging scan. And if they see that, that's typically an indicator that there is a tumor there. So that's another way of identifying if someone has cancer or not. And so they decided to perform a PET scan, even though there was only a 10% chance that the cancerous cells had broken off from the initial tumor and spread to other parts of my body. They still wanted to perform a PET scan to remove all doubt so I could rest peacefully at night, or that we all could rest peacefully at night. And so that's what I was at the cancer center for. Now, I have to admit, you know, throughout this entire process, I've been really trying my best to, you know, be optimistic, but I also have been probably favoring worst case scenario this entire time because I didn't want to be surprised with the bad news. And if it was the bad news, if it wasn't worst case scenario, then that would be great. But if it was the worst case scenario, I would have been prepared for that, which, you know, it's stressful and it really weighs you down. Because the worst case scenario in this case is, you know, obviously one of the worst case scenarios that someone can be faced with. So when I'm waiting around in the lobby, the cancer center lobby, I'm noticing a few things. And I'm sitting there, and I have my head down for the most part. I brought a crossword puzzle with me, and just to kind of keep my mind off things as best I could. But I'll be honest, that was the most emotional that I had been throughout this entire journey. Like I was very vulnerable in that lobby that particular day. I think it was just the weight of the entire summer was just like hinging on that last announcement, because this entire time I've really never had closure. It was always like, okay, well, you're going to have surgery. Okay, well, the surgery, it went well, but we still don't have the final answer. And then when I had the PET scan, still didn't have a final answer. So this was an opportunity for me to finally understand if the cancer had been fully removed from my body or not. So I'm looking around, and one of the first observations that I have is that cancer does not discriminate. And it impacts everybody. Regardless of your race, regardless of your socioeconomic status, your personality, your occupation, we're all in there. But with that being said, I noticed that I was by far the youngest person in that lobby. And I think that hit me kind of hard, because every single person that I was waiting with, in my opinion, was in their 80s. And I'm 39. So assuming that they are in their 80s, I was half of everyone's age in there, except for maybe one or two. You know, over the course of the time that I was waiting there, which ended up being about 45 minutes, I was waiting 45 minutes past the time I should have been, which didn't help my anxiety at all. I would say 90% were 80 or above, and maybe a few were a little bit younger. But as I'm sitting there, I'm realizing the mentality of most of the people that are waiting in the waiting room. There was one person on their cell phone and they were laughing with a family member. I had someone that had lost their hair due to chemotherapy, and she was incredibly jovial and laughing with the receptionists. And it was very inspiring. It's very inspiring to be around so many people that were, facing death. And I don't know exactly what their circumstances were or how far along they were or what their prognosis was or if there was a timeline given, but the vast majority of the people that were waiting in that lobby had figured out a way to be happy, which I found very inspiring. And I've talked a little bit about that in previous episodes and how something like cancer or how something like a terminal illness, it really impacts you. And you have really a couple different options in how you can handle that. And for me, I noticed that at least initially, everything became an opportunity to be happy and to make a memory. And I have never felt more present in my entire life than when I was first diagnosed with this. But the last thing I really am noticing was the music. And so I'm sitting there and for the most part, the music was incredibly uplifting. It was like pop, spanning different decades, but it was up-tempo. It was inspiring. It was motivating. And I can't really remember like specific songs except for one, but I remember thinking like, wow, this is the first time I've really kind of actively thought about the music that was being played. And I'm like, you know what? I bet someone did a study at some point in time and they realized the importance of music in these type of scenarios. And if they haven't, they should. Because I think it's really important that lobbies of cancer centers or oncologist offices, that they pay close attention to that. Because I remember that when I was listening to those songs, it helped improve my mood. Now, I felt it was a very purposeful act until I came across one of the most emotional songs that I have ever heard. And it's, I think, one of the most beautiful songs that has ever been recorded. And let me tell you, man, this is not a song that you want to listen to. When you're in there for cancer. And so it wasn't until I heard that song that I realized that all the positive, uplifting, inspirational songs were just a pure accident. It was just a random playlist. This entire time, I'm like, man, someone's really thoughtful. That someone really did their research and their homework, and they realized the importance of playing uplifting music, and they did the research and they realized the psychology and the impact on your subconscious and your conscious, you know, behaviors and thoughts and emotions. No, it was just like a random Pandora station, probably. Because when you hear Bonnie Raitt's "I Can't Make You Love Me," when you are in that state of mind, I don't know how I held it together. Of all the songs they had to play that. Now, it's actually appropriate that they played that song because it made me think about the last episode, and I talk a lot about what is art, and I talk about what art means to me. I ask you to think about what art means to you. And it's funny because I actually was revisiting my own definition almost immediately after recording that episode because, as I mentioned in another episode, my wife and I have been trying to get caught up with Star Wars, and went back in the house and we were watching Clone Wars. I don't think that's the full title, but it's one of the episodes. For all of you Star Wars fanatics out there, you're just cringing at my ignorance. But anyways, we're watching the Clone Wars and it's like all computer animated, and I'm starting to realize like maybe I'm selling technology short a little bit. You know, obviously I'm an oil painter and I'm biased towards favoring a more traditional art expression or art form, because it is unadulterated. And again, I'm showing my bias in using that term. But I think there's something to be said, though, in incorporating technology, because as I'm watching this video, I'm realizing that without technology, you wouldn't be able to create those scenes. And so the artist that is responsible for creating those battle scenes has to leverage technology in some capacity to achieve their vision. And so I understood, as I'm watching that film, how technology can be leveraged to create a more fulfilled vision. And so I had to kind of revisit my own definition. And I think it's good to always be revisiting our belief systems and to challenge what we think. But anyway, so I'm thinking about this song, and I'm listening to Bonnie Raitt's version, because some of you may be more familiar with Adele's version, which I personally think is better than Bonnie Raitt's version. Now, and when I say better, I think that there's more emotion. I can feel more emotion in Adele's version. I think there's more depth to her voice. She has a far greater range, and that's just me as an untrained, you know, singer. So take that for what it's worth. But to me, I like Adele's version better. It hits harder for me. Now, with that being said, and again, going back to my definition of what is art, I think Bonnie Raitt's is more artistic. I believe Bonnie Raitt's version of I Can't Make You Love Me is more artistic because she was the original artist. And without Bonnie Raitt's version, there probably isn't an Adele version. So you have to give credit to Bonnie Raitt for being the one, the pioneer behind that song, for being the original artist to perform that song. And for me, there should be points awarded for her originality. Now, there's another reason why I feel like Bonnie Raitt's version of I Can't Make You Love Me is a classic example of what I define as art. One, because it's original. Two, it's very emotional. There are very genuine emotions that she was pouring into her art. And as a result, you're able to experience those same emotions as a recipient of her art. Now, I was researching this song because when she sings it, you want to get, or I got the perception that she wrote the song and that this was written due to a very specific experience that she had. But it turns out that wasn't necessarily the case. Now, it turns out that there were two writers that are responsible for the song. And I'm trying to pull it up. I took some screenshots of a few articles that I was using for this podcast. And I pulled up, but I don't think I actually had the name of the writers right in front of me. But this is from Smooth Radio, for what it's worth. Okay, now it says, what is the song about? So the idea for the song came to Reed, so that's the name of one of the artists, or one of the writers, I should say, after reading an article about a man arrested for getting drunk and shooting at his girlfriend's car. The judge asked him if he had learned anything, to which he replied, I learned, Your Honor, that you can't make a woman love you if she don't. that's just so ridiculous. Like, what an extreme take. You know, just shooting at your girlfriend's car. Anyways, so Raitt recorded the vocal in just one take in the studio. So that is another reason why I think this song is so incredible, because she said that it was so sad a song that she could not recapture the emotion. Quote, we try to do it again, and I just said, you know, this ain't going to happen. So for those of you that are familiar with that song, or if you haven't listened to the song before, please do. That was recorded on her first take. Again, because that was the only way that she could guarantee pouring that much emotion and soul into the song, which I found absolutely fascinating. All right, and in the song, Raitt depicts a now one-sided romantic relationship that is about to end in soft but brutally honest terms. Now, to continue with this article, it said it wasn't a massive hit. Right? So the song reached number 18 in the US and wasn't even released in the UK at the time. However, it has since been considered a classic. In 2000, Mojo magazine placed it at number 8 on its 100 greatest songs of all time. So that was pretty noteworthy. Now, Adele was interviewed because, again, as I mentioned before, she did a cover for this song. And Adele said that it is one of her favorite songs and described it as perfect in every way. Quote, "It makes me really, really happy and really, really devastated and depressed at the same time. It makes me think of my fondest and best times in my life, and it makes me think of the worst as well, and combined, probably is a recipe for disaster, but I do love this song. It's just stunning." End quote, Adele. Now that quote is another reason why I find this song to be very artistic, because it provides a range of emotions. But it is so just authentic and honest sounding, and it's very vulnerable. And that's what I've always tried to achieve with this podcast. And that's why I love this podcast as a form of art or expression. I've tried to be vulnerable. I've tried to be honest and authentic and provide you the highs and the lows and moments of vulnerability and moments where sometimes I honestly question if I should reveal that part about myself. But I think it's all very important to communicate all of that because I think it is valuable. I think it can be used to inspire you. I think it could be used to reveal the artist that is responsible for the art that I'm producing so you have a better sense for the meaning behind what I'm doing. But again, it's important for you to understand and be okay with the fact that journeys include this wide range of emotions, and that, you know, especially in today's day and age, when you look at social media, and I'll be honest, I mean, my social media account is guilty of this too. You know, we're just posting our highlights. You know, my Instagram is really like a business portfolio, and that's what I've used it for. And so it is just the highlights, but it doesn't tell you the full story, not even close. You know, it doesn't tell you about all the times where I'm discouraged. It doesn't tell you about all the times where I've reached out to people and they don't even bother responding back, or any of that, or the moments of doubt or the moments of failures. But all of those parts of the journey are equally as important. And so in going back to those failures and looking at that song and realizing that when it was first published, it wasn't really that big of a hit, even though now it's considered a classic and by some publications one of the greatest songs of all time, which is quite the accolade. And honestly, that gives me confidence. It gives me reassurance that even though I may not be finding the success that I want for myself right now, doesn't mean that it's not going to happen down the road. And that was very reassuring and comforting to read, that a song that is as classic and as well renowned and well respected as you know, Bonnie Raitt's I can't make you love me. You know, it didn't experience initial success. And the whole song itself, I Can't Make You Love Me, is just an incredible message in and of itself. You know, as an artist, I can't make people love me. I can't make people follow me. I can't make people like my posts or buy my art or support me in any way. And it's actually very freeing to admit that. And I'm in such a better place now than when I first started this podcast, and I just felt like I was up against like a really strict deadline, that I had to meet certain quotas and meet certain benchmarks by certain dates. And it really takes a lot of fun out of it. And so now I'm just to the point where it's taken me a long time to get here. Long time, relatively speaking, about a year and a half. But I'm finally to the point now where I am okay with that. Where, look, I'm just going to create the art that makes sense to me, that is an honest and authentic expression of myself, what I feel is original, what I feel embodies all the values that I try to live my life by, And if you like it, great. And if not, that's okay too, because I'm not changing. Because this art means too much to me. And I get so much satisfaction out of creating this art that I'm not willing to give that up. And there's going to be a couple more examples of that growth in the next few episodes that I plan on sharing with you. Now, listening to these songs and reflecting on music and all of that, I mean, I was in that waiting room for about 45 minutes. And so the longer that the time goes by, I'm getting more worried. I'm like, what is taking so long? Is it just like really terrible news and the doctor's back there like, you know, trying to motivate themselves that they can have this conversation with me? I mean, that's what I was thinking. And I was like, all right, you know, this is ridiculous. Just like calm down. You don't know what's happening. Now, before I get called back into the waiting room, I'm going to share with you a story that you probably won't believe. Just like some of the stories that I've shared in these last few episodes, they seem so outlandish. And I don't think I can blame you for not believing them, because they are so bizarre and you have not experienced them. So, you know, you will probably have a difficult time believing them, which I get. But I'm going to tell you another story that is so outlandish, but it happened. And it's a very powerful reminder of the powers or the mysteries of the universe and the powers of our minds and our thoughts. And it had a very profound impact on me when I was sitting in the waiting room. You know, and I didn't really tell a lot of people. You know, I told a handful of people. I told my family, obviously, and I told my boss at work. And I'm on a group chat with some of my childhood friends, some of my closest friends. We went on a golf trip recently, and so I just decided to drop it in the group chat just so they're aware. I mentioned something on an Instagram story once, and I told all of you guys. And that was it. I didn't really reach out to too many people. I thought that it was important to reach out to some people because it is a risk. I was completely ignorant to the risk of skin cancer. So I felt like some people should know. Now, for the past several weeks now, I've been kicking myself because there is one person that I really felt like I should tell. And for whatever reason, I was just dropping the ball completely. I just was either remembering to like contact him and then I was busy and didn't think of it, or I just kept on putting it off. I don't know. It was just inexplicable, but there was just one person that I felt like I needed to tell. And I just kept on thinking about it, and I kept on thinking about it, and I never did anything about it. And one reason I wanted to tell him, one, he's just a good friend. He's just a really genuine guy, a good friend that I've known for a long time. He's a teacher just like I am. He's a coach, and he's a really accomplished football coach. And he spends a lot of time outside in the sun, especially during the summer, during summer workouts. So I was like, you know, I need to tell him. I need to make sure that he's going to the dermatologist, especially considering how much time he's spending out in the sun. Well, I'm sitting there in a waiting room, and his mom walks through the doors. I'm not making this up. I know it's going to sound like I'm making this up, but I'm not. Of all the people to walk through the lobby doors of the cancer center, his mom walks through the doors. Now, I am covered in tattoos, so I'm pretty easy to pick out in a lobby. And so I really didn't feel comfortable talking to her because I didn't know why she was there. I mean, obviously either she had cancer or someone close to her had cancer. I wasn't in the greatest emotional state to be having a conversation. So I was really trying to avoid any conversation at all. So she walked past me and I'm just like focusing on my crossword, so I don't make eye contact and she hopefully doesn't see me. And then again, she's like walking by me and I can tell that she notices me, but she's not saying anything. And I've decided not to say anything. And it's just like one of those moments in our lives where, you know, neither one of us really was in a position or was willing to talk in that moment in time. And I was like, you know what, man, that's a sign. I gotta contact I don't want to say his real name, just in case there's people listening that know me. I don't want them knowing my friend's business. All right, but I'm going to pull up the conversation so you know that it was an authentic interaction here. All right, so this is on August 9th. "Hey, buddy, I've been meaning to reach out to you for a while. For whatever reason, I haven't, mostly because I think I've been waiting on my latest results. I saw your mom at the cancer center here in Frederick, and I hope everything is okay with your family. I took it as a sign that I need to finally reach you. To make a really long story short, I had a melanoma removed from my head. I had a mole on the side of my head that turned cancerous. It was caught by a dermatologist when I went in for something unrelated. I'm in the center today because I'm waiting on my PET scan results to ensure it's all gone. Just wanted to encourage you to schedule a dermatologist appointment ASAP if you haven't been within the last year, especially considering how much time you spend in the sun." I don't think I need to read his response, but basically he explains, you know, he's appreciative of the text. He explains why his mom was in there. But pretty remarkable coincidence. So after all that, after seeing my buddy's mom walk in, after listening to "I Can't Make You Love Me" when I'm in the most vulnerable moment of my life, an entire month of battling, just really unknown, because I wasn't, you know, physically struggling, I finally get called back. And I go back there, and, you know, to the nurse's credit, she's trying to crack jokes, or she's trying to, like, lighten the mood, and I'm not in the mood. I'm not biting. I'm like, "Look, you know, like, I appreciate what you're," like, inside, internally, I'm like, "I appreciate what you're doing, but just, come on, just put me in the room and tell me what's going on." So she brings up her laptop, and she's looking through everything, and she goes, "So why are you in here?" So I tell her everything. And she goes, "Okay, well, you know, I appreciate how patient you've been." And then she looks at me dead in the eyes and she goes, "It shouldn't be a long appointment." And I'm like, "Okay, well, I think what you're saying is that you see the results on your laptop there and they are positive. And therefore, I'm not going to ask a lot of questions, or there's not a lot to go over. So it's going to be a short appointment. That's how I am interpreting your message, but I also don't want to believe that, because what if it's the complete opposite and you just give me false hope?" So then the doctor comes in and he pulls up the PET scan images and he explains very carefully and he articulates everything that is necessary in properly interpreting the images. And he says that he was unable to detect any sign of cancer. And I think I was still just in survival mode and not really just trying to stay balanced no matter what the results were. So it didn't really hit me until after I left the appointment. So he tells me the great news. He says that I need to schedule dermatologist appointments, you know, every 3 months. He wants to schedule another PET scan in about a year or 6 months just to make sure. Just very diligent about everything. Got my papers. I walk out of there. I walk to my car. And I just let it all out. And it wasn't until that moment that I just fully could relax. You know, I found out before school ended, probably the first week of June, I believe. And since that initial diagnosis, I've kind of thought in the back of my mind that I was possibly dying. And it's, you don't realize how much of a burden that is. And you're trying to stay strong and you're trying to feel optimistic. You're trying to be rational. You're trying to be practical and understand, you know, what is possible, but you're also trying to be optimistic. It's a very difficult and challenging balancing act. But in the back of your mind, you're having to come face to face with this realization that your time may be coming to an end. or at least much sooner than you were expecting. And when you have a family and when you have lots of dreams and unfinished business, that can be a really devastating reality. And I finally was in a position where everything just, I could finally just release everything. Just a few months of just bullshit that I hope I never have to go through again. Now, even though in the PET scan appointment with my oncologist, he said that he did not see any visible signs of cancer, he had to officially wait to hear back from the radiologist. So even though I just felt like this huge burden off my shoulders, because I knew that even if there was some sort of trace in the radiologist appointment or radiologist report, that I knew that it wasn't going to be something of any real significance, that it was hopefully going to be just such a small trace that any sort of immunotherapy could wipe it out very quickly. But I still technically didn't have a full clean bill of health, even when I left my oncologist appointment, even when I was sitting in my car. It wasn't until the next day, I believe, that I got a call back from my surgeon, and he confirmed that the radiologist report said that there wasn't any trace of cancer. And by that point, I had let out a lot of my emotion already, and I was very positive. And again, I just knew that even if there was a trace, it would be nominal. So the likelihood that I was going to be able to come back from it was very high. But I'm cancer-free now. And all that's out. And I have a gnarly scar to prove it on the side of my head. I don't think the hair is going to grow back, even though they keep on saying that it's going to, or they've said on multiple occasions. But it's been over a month, and there's no sign of hair at all along that incision. But it is what it is. I could care less. I'm very grateful for that scar. And I think that we have to be grateful for our scars in general. Our physical scars, our scars from failures and from heartache and all of that. Because it just shows that we're human. It shows that we've experienced these raw emotions that I think are so critical to experiencing a full life. You know, I have a newfound appreciation for those emotions. And I have a newfound appreciation for aging. I was coming across something on, or I came across something on Instagram, and I have a friend that is battling MS. And she said something that really resonated with me. And she was like, you know, it's a privilege to age. And it truly is. You know, I'm almost 40 years old, and I used to look really young, and I think COVID and or raising two young kids during COVID and all the stress with teaching during COVID and just the stress of life and everything, it was catching up to me. And so these last few years, I feel like I've aged tremendously. And it's, you know, I don't think anyone really enjoys that part of the aging process, the physical deterioration of your skin and muscles and everything. But it's a privilege. I finally realized it's a privilege to experience that. Because not everyone gets a chance to do that. Not everyone has a chance to live until they're 40 years old. And that helped me with a newfound appreciation of my lines, of my scars, because they're all stories. They're all memories. They're all emotions. They're all part of this experience. They're all part of the journey.
Thanks for listening to the Painting the Midnight Oil podcast. Come back soon.